Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. David Brown, Goldsmiths, University of London. On this episode, I'm talking to Professor Nick Crossley from the University of Manchester about his new book, Networks of Sound, Style and Subversion, The Punk and Post-Punk Worlds of Manchester, London, Liverpool and Sheffield, 1975-80. Okay, welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Professor Nick Crossley, who works in the Sociology Department at the University of Manchester, about his new book, Networks of Sound, Style and Subversion, The Punk and Post-Punk Worlds of Manchester, London, Liverpool and Sheffield, 1975-80. Hello.
Hi.
So, to start off with this, I really enjoyed this, partially because it's a really good, solid, theoretically grounded bit of sociology, but also it's about punk and it's dead interesting. It was a real pleasure to read. And I wonder, actually, before we get into it, if you could tell the listeners a bit about the process that brought you to write this book. So a bit about your academic background and why you've ended up applying social network analysis to the book.
Yep, sure. Well, firstly, thanks very much. I'm glad that you enjoyed it. So the background to it, I've done a lot of work on social movements. So looking at different protest groups and how they form and mobilise. And really, as I suppose partly as a consequence of that, I started to get interested in network analysis. I think I reached a point where the social movements were quite difficult. It was quite difficult to get information about the social movements involved, the social networks rather, involved in many kinds of social movements. And I think in the process of working through that, I began to think about what I already knew about punk and the networks involved in that. And I think part of it was to do with teaching. I wanted some easy-ish sorts of examples of social networks to work with, and I kind of thought, well, maybe the social movements are difficult to get hold of, but maybe thinking about punk would be easier. So I started to put a network together just on the basis of, because I'd been a huge punk fan as a kid, and started to put the network together on that basis. Then I started Googling a few people, and it turned out that there was even more of a network than I'd imagined that there was on the basis of what I remembered. And then I think I started to think, well, maybe I could get a paper out of this. Maybe there's enough there. And in particular, thinking about the parallels between social movements and what I was thinking of at the time as musical movements. And starting to sort of think, well, maybe the arguments that say there has to be a network in order for a social movement to form or a protest to happen, it applies in the case of music as well. Maybe you don't get things like punk unless there's already some kind of pre-existing network there. And that was really the strand of thought, I think, that started me off on the whole process that eventually, 5 or 6 years later, led to me starting to write the book.
I mean, it's funny in a way that punk, and maybe to a lesser extent, post-punk, is stuff that in contemporary culture, we just assume we understand. But one of the things the book does is intervenes in a way that says, what you think you know about punk, you probably don't. So I wonder if you could say what punk is, perhaps a little bit about what post-punk is, and how the book challenges expectations around the kind of the dominant stories of punk.
Right. Those questions, what it is, are very, very difficult. And I'm not sure that I've got a perfect answer to that. Because I suppose questions about what it is belong to the world of punk itself and will always be argued about. So as I was looking at the London punks, I was looking at the networks that formed around the Sex Pistols, you see lots of debates there with the older pub rockers, Dr. Feelgood, Ian Dury, and people who are saying, well, we were doing it before you were doing it. We're the original punks. And then there's all the debates about what was happening in the United States as well, around CBGB, where television, Patti Smith, the Ramones, and these kinds of groups were all starting to form. And indeed, the earlier waves of the Stooges and the MC5 and these other kinds of things. And so in some senses, I daren't answer the question, what is punk?
Yeah. You know,
because whatever answer I came up with would undoubtedly be wrong in the view of lots of people. But I think I just became interested in the network that involved the London punk groups initially that I'd grown up loving. So the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Banshees, the Damned, the Slits, Chelsea, Generation X, those bands. And I think that was where I'd started with the network. I knew that Bernie Rhodes and Malcolm McLaren, the managers of the Sex Pistols and the Clash respectively, knew one another. And so that was kind of where I started. And I suppose that for me, that particular world, as I call it, or that particular movement, was what it was that I wanted to focus upon. And I think it was that cluster of bands and the people involved there who generated all the excitement that I got swept up in and that meant so much to me. So I think that was a kind of a locus of interaction and activity and excitement, and I call that punk. I'm kind of prepared to accept that, you know, it might just be one version of it or whatever else, but that was it for me. And then I think from that hive of activity in London, you get a diffusion outwards to mainly to other cities initially, and perhaps initially to Manchester, because some early links that were formed between between London and Manchester, but also to places like Liverpool and to Sheffield. And you get a process, a very similar process to the one that I observed in London, happening in Liverpool, in Manchester, in Sheffield, and in lots of other towns and cities in the UK. But what happens? And I was really struck when I was looking through the archives of just about how obvious and apparent this becomes, is that within the space of 6 to 12 months of punk having really gone public and become something that lots of people knew about, a lot of the instigators, the people who'd been involved early on, were starting to get bored of it and were starting to say, we don't want to just simply reproduce this format of, you know, whatever. I mean, I think sometimes we tend to we tend to assume that punk music was more simple than it was, and, you know, we either celebrate that or we condemn it. But nevertheless, that format was something that people began to become irritated about and wanted to move away from. And perhaps punk itself was becoming uniform in the sense that a movement which had initially, or a world which had initially been centred upon people experimenting and doing their own things and trying out all sorts of different styles had become centered upon bondage trousers and jack boots and leather jackets and a very sort of stereotyped style and view. And so you start to get people who are still inspired by the DIY ethos of punk. They're still inspired by the idea that you can and should do it yourself. But what they want to do, the style of music that they want to work with, is different. And interestingly, although I don't want to overgeneralize too much, but you get different styles developing in different cities. I mean, so Liverpool is always, I think, thought of as the home of psychedelic music or neo psychedelic music. And whilst there were loads of things going on in Liverpool, have loads of people doing different sorts of things. There certainly was that hub of bands working around a loosely psychedelic theme, Echo and the Bunnymen, Teardrop Explodes, Wah. And I guess that was related to some extent to the central importance of Probe Records and the interests of the people who worked there. In Sheffield, by contrast, you had this real focus on electronic music that was related to Cabaret Voltaire, the Human League, Clock de Var, and so on. And so you had these distinctive sounds emerging in different cities, but they were all in some senses post-punk because they were all about taking the DIY ethos of punk, taking the idea of, yeah, we're going to do it for ourselves and we're going to enjoy it, but taking it off in different directions. And I think also what you had in there were people who perhaps were never that persuaded by the punk style itself. I think this is probably true in Sheffield of some of the electronic pioneers. They were never completely persuaded of the punk bands and punk styles, but they loved the idea that you could do it yourself, and they wanted to do that with their own sort of chosen forms of music. So I mean, and that really was what post-punk was, I think. And there was also a network. So there was lots of movement between Liverpool and Manchester and Sheffield and Manchester. I think geographically Manchester was just in the middle. So the two tended to converge around there. And that became even truer with the independent record labels as well, that you started to get these intercity or translocal networks forming that gave this diverse range of activities some kind of connectedness and cohesion.
I mean, it's funny in a way, because over the course of that explanation, you're already gesturing towards the more technical aspects of sociological analysis there in the book, particularly around social network analysis,
yeah,
but also some of the theoretical work you do around trying to establish what it is exactly that you're studying. So what's the idea of a musical world? And I think that is tied up with the kind of the boundary making around punk. And yeah, it's not a scene. It's something that's different from a subculture.
Yeah. I mean, this is perhaps the controversial bit, in the sense that this is the bit that some people like and other people don't like. I think the idea that there are a number of different concepts, as you've just said, that are on offer for thinking about the collectives that are involved in music making. The one that has been predominant in British sociology, or was predominant for many years, is the idea of subculture. And then, like you said, there's the idea of scene, there's Bourdieu's idea of field, and there's this idea of world. And I suspect you could probably go with anyone. I mean, if you had a preference for any one of them, you could make a case for it and you could go with it. But I was particularly I was particularly impressed with the work of Howard Becker and Howard Becker's ideas on art worlds. And it seemed to me that that Becker offered a coherent set of interrelated concepts which allowed you to think about music or any kind of art, in fact, but music as collective action. It encouraged you to look at the ways in which people cooperated and also sometimes competed and conflicted with one another in the process of art, and which emphasized that art was always a co-creation. It always involved the different input of these people playing different roles. And although Becker's original formulation isn't perfect, it was the one that really captured me, the one that inspired me. And it seemed to me that it was, for example, it was a cohesive set of theoretical ideas, but it wasn't it wasn't closed in the way that sometimes Bourdieu's idea of fields can be. It seemed to invite you to push off in different kinds of directions. It wasn't quite as prescriptive, I don't think, as Bourdieu's idea of fields was. But then there's still some sort of cohesion to it, where in contrast, say, to the concept of scene, which I think there are just lots of different versions of, and those different versions of it conflict with one another. So it doesn't, whilst any one version of scene might be coherent, people understand very different things by the word scene if you use it. And so that seemed to perhaps be problematic. And I suppose the contrast really with subculture was that the idea of subculture seemed to be very much focused on audiences alone. And yet the notion of world seemed to include artists and audiences and all the various support personnel that are necessary for music to happen. So, like I say, I mean, any advocate of any of the other concepts would probably do a similar job of explaining why theirs is best. Yeah, but that's why I opted for this idea of worlds. And also, interestingly, Becker puts quite an emphasis upon networks. And that resonated with where I'd come into the idea of networks. And it seemed, although he didn't develop it in a technical way via social network analysis, it seemed to me that he kind of invited you to do that. That was part of the potential of this notion, was that you could take that element of worlds and do something more with it via social network analysis. And I think, the one other thing was that took me was Becker's idea of art as collective action, which then resonated with my earlier interests as a social movement scholar. And so there was this kind of sense of, well, yeah, you, if you're thinking of Becker's, was the concept which resonated most closely with my sense that the uprising that was punk was sociologically very similar to the uprising that was May 68, or the uprising that the formation of the environmental movement.
I mean, social network analysis is obviously the other kind of the major thing going on in the book. And I'd be interested to hear, you know, you maybe talk through that or give a brief explanation about it. But one of the things I was very struck by was the book is not doing social network analysis of punk because it's something that, you know, would be technically interesting but would not destabilize the literature or bring anything new.
Yeah.
The book is using social network analysis to kind of take on existing explanations
of punk.
So I wonder if you could sort of talk through what an SNA is in a way that kind of makes it clear why doing a social network analysis is different to, say, explaining punk as, you know, the frustrations of contemporary, in the 70s, British masculinity, or Malcolm McLaren's fashion label, or these other structural or individualist explanations that are already out there.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, I'll start with the other explanations then. So there are a few fairly standard explanations of punk. I mean, I guess coming from the Birmingham Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies, punk is seen as an expression of the alienation of working class youth. It's a response to that. Or another version of that is the idea that punk was a response to the economic crisis of the mid 1970s. Or again, another sort of explanation along those lines was the idea that it was frustration at what rock and pop music had become in the mid 1970s. So you've got a generation of people who grow up with rock and roll, then they move through the Mersey beat, they get they grow up with Motown, and then they get in the mid 1970s and they've got Mud and Sweet and these kind of, you know, I mean, I think that many of them found David Bowie really exciting, but glam rock had almost become a parody of itself by the mid-1970s. And then on the other side, you've got, you know, you've Emerson, Lake and Palmer and these very grandiose pretensions. And so punk is seen as a response to the frustration that that caused. And the problem with that sort of explanation, any of those explanations for me, and really here I'm just nicking a critique that's used in social movement studies very often, is that frustration was ubiquitous. I mean, I found examples of it in Manchester, in Liverpool. There's clearly people were frustrated. They were frustrated economically and politically. They were frustrated about music. Young working class people were alienated. But the problem was that was happening everywhere. Yeah. And punk didn't happen everywhere.
Yeah.
Punk happened in very specific kinds of places. And so I wanted to know, well, why or how did it happen in the very specific places that it did? And I suppose it's more of a how than a why, because I think there's an element of chance in it. I think it could have happened first in Liverpool. I mean, I don't know that I should go how much detail I should go into about this, but you look at what was happening in Liverpool with the band Deaf School in the early 1970s, and they were starting to make many of the same noises, you know, pun intended, in Liverpool that would later lead to something happening in London. So it could have happened in Liverpool. Lots of grumbling in Manchester about the labels and the selling out of the... So it could have happened in Manchester, but it happened first in London. And so I wanted to know, well, what was the process? How did it happen? And that starts then, I think, to focus you more upon the set of people who were involved and the kind of what social movement theorists have called the micro-mobilisation processes. How did it just come about that these people started doing what they were doing? And in order to answer that question, I then came back to this idea of network. And you know, I sort of thought, well, perhaps what you have in Manchester and in Liverpool is a set of people with very similar sentiments to the people in London, but they're not connected to one another. So their frustrations are, and they're not connected to people who might be in a position to do something with this. And what the difference in London was that these different people with these same interests began to converge and began to form a network. And my argument was and is that it was the network which enabled the collective action to happen. When people started to connect with one another, they began to share resources, they began to influence one another, they began to compete with one another, they began to share ideas, and it was through those processes of interaction that something began to take shape, that what we later recognise as punk began to take shape. And so, but in order to make that case persuasively, I couldn't just offer the impression that, well, yeah, it looks to me like all the people in London knew one another and were interacting with one another, and all the people in Manchester weren't. So that was really, I suppose, where social network analysis, which I knew from my social movements research, came into action, because social network analysis was a very precise way of mapping the networks and saying who is interacting with whom in insignificant and important ways, and indeed, to some extent, who even knows whom. And so I set about, that was when I set about going in a more systematic way through the archives and just looking at who the key players were in Manchester and London, and trying to work out at what point they knew one another and at what point they began to interact with one another. And the difference really between Manchester and London was that networks had begun to take shape in London much earlier than they did in Manchester. So there were eventually there were networks in both cities, but it was the process of network formation which happened earlier in London and which seems to have been the basis upon which punk happened. But the network was also a way of combating what you also referred to in the question, the overly individualistic explanations of punk that we get. So in particular, John Lydon or Johnny Rotten and Malcolm McLaren are sometimes identified as the people who made punk, and it was all down to whichever one of the two you prefer, or sometimes perhaps both. And it seems to me, firstly, the art world's idea, Becker's art world's idea, is challenging that. Part of the reason for saying art is collective action is to get away from the idea that art is reducible to the genius or charisma of any particular single person. But also the network analysis was a way of trying to begin to explore that. Because for me, McLaren and Johnny Rotten were hugely important, and I have no doubt that that the particular shape that punk took was influenced to a huge extent by each of them, but it couldn't have happened unless they were a part of a network. It couldn't have happened unless they had connections to other people who were impressed by what they did, who were sympathetic to what they did. And clearly that wasn't going to be everybody. Lots of people were distinctly underwhelmed by the Sex Pistols and McLaren, or horrified by them. But when you had a network of people who had begun to share particular kind of sentiment, and then you had people in that network who were good organisers, or who were charismatic, at least charismatic to the other people in the network, those people were able to be operators, or were able to steer and lead a movement in the way that they did. But it can't be reducible to the individual. It's got to be the individual as a player within a wider network.
I mean, you sort of talked about this a little bit already, but I wonder if you could illustrate this by talking through, which is essentially chapters 4 through 6, talking through the story of punk's emergence in London.
Yeah, right. So I think it's a long story.
I know, yeah.
And it's a complicated story. But I suppose the starting point for me is Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood's shop, which had various different names at different times. But Sex is the name that it had for most of the early formation of punk on the King's Road. And McLaren had and Westwood had originally sold Teddy Boy clothes, and then later on had gone to, I think, borrowing ideas from other people, had decided that the trappings of sexual fetishism might be a basis for provocative everyday clothes and clothes that people might wear out on the streets. And so had the idea of the bondage trousers and the bum flaps and all these various kinds of things comes from. And I think that, I mean, firstly, McLaren himself had an interest in network way before the start of punk. He had connections to Jamie Reed, who was a situationist artist. He had rock music connections to some extent, because he'd made contact with the New York Dolls in the early 1970s, and he supplied some of their clothes. He had links with, and this is a test of whether I can remember people's names, he had links with The guy who was in the Sharks, who was Chris Spedding, who had played with Roy Harper and various other kinds of people. So there was this interesting network of artists, businessmen connected to the shop, but also the shop became a place where young people who were interested in subcultural fashions and slightly more out there clothes came to buy their clothes. Because even in London, I think there were very few places where you could go, even, for example, and buy brothel creepers or the kind of fairly standard but challenging clothes. And so McLaren's shop, along with one or two others, began to attract lots of young people. And some of these young people were interested in forming bands. And the obvious example of that is Steve Jones and Paul Cook, who would later be the guitarist and the drummer with the Sex Pistols. And they used to hang around McLaren's shop, and as the story goes, they used to try and nick things from McLaren's shop. But also they would work at the shop. McLaren would get Steve Jones doing odd jobs for him and working around. And actually, interestingly, at that time, Chrissy Hynde, who was, of course, later in The Pretenders, was working at McLaren's shop. And Steve Jones and Paul Cook approached McLaren and said, would he manage their band? And my impression at this time is that McLaren said yes, but McLaren wasn't that interested in music at this particular point in time. He'd been disenchanted by the changes in music, really since rock and roll. He'd been a big fan of Eddie Cochran and that whole sort of early the early Billy Fury, the whole early rock and roll scene, and he thought that music had gone to pieces pretty much after rock and roll. so he wasn't that interested, but he said he would do it. And he also put Steve Jones and Paul Cook in contact with Glenn Matlock, who would be the bassist of the Sex Pistols. And Matlock was based at one of the art colleges just down the road from the shop, he got into contact with them, and so a band began to take shape, but not a band that McLaren was necessarily all that interested in. And the band tried out different vocalists at different times, but this band also became a focus of interest for some of McLaren's other associates within and connected to the shop. And in particular, I think during early 1975, or at some point in 1975, the New York Dolls were apparently in their death throes. They were kind of they were struggling as a band. And the one band that McLaren did still like were the New York Dolls. He thought they were sort of provocative and challenging, and they did what rock and roll was supposed to do, which was terrify parents and sort of be outrageous. So McLaren took it upon himself to go over to the States to try to help the New York Dolls out, and it was a disastrous attempt. By all accounts, he had them dressing up with hammer and sickle type designs, which didn't go down
well. Hopefully not,
in the States. And in effect, his intervention seems to have just, you know, killed them off completely. But whilst he was away, Bernie Rhodes, who was his friend and worked on T-shirts and things with him, and Jamie Reed, who was the kind of situationist artist, had been meeting up with the band, and they'd been sort of talking about what they should do. And Rhodes was a bit of a provocateur as well. He wanted them to do controversial and challenging things. And Jamie Reed had the interest in situationism, and he was talking to the band and trying to. And they were, these guys, I think, were trying to impose their designs upon the band a little bit. And I think whilst McLaren was in the States, he came across what was happening at CBGB. And so he started to see these exciting bands. I think in particular, Television, he was very impressed with, in Richard Hell. And by all accounts, Richard Hell had clothes held together by safety pins, spiky hair, and all the rest of it. And so when McLaren came back, he was more interested in music, and he decided that he wanted to do something with his band. And part of what he wanted to do was to bring either Johnny Thunders or Richard Hell over from the States and have them in his band, which neither of them wanted to do. But I think in this process, Bernie Rhodes was pushed out again a little bit, sparking a bit more competition, I think, between Bernie Rhodes and Malcolm McLaren. If McLaren had his band, Rhodes wanted to have his band. And then, in an interesting link, Bernie Rhodes went to see the Liverpool band Deaf School, where he met up with Mick Jones and with Tony James, who were looking to put together a band, and they started talking, and Rhodes took it upon himself to manage their band, who originally called London SS. But obviously, Mick Jones would eventually become The Clash, Tony James would eventually become Chelsea and Generation X, and Brian James came into that fold fairly early on, and his band would be The Damned. So what you're starting to get is all these would-be musicians who are linking up with this infrastructure around McLaren's shop. And I suppose that's the start of a process of network formation. I mean, it would be, I won't go into length about how everybody else all started to come into the network.
Yeah, one of the things you do in chapter 5 is illustrate how, you know, we can see distinct blocks in the world of London punk that are interrelated with each other, some of which are, helping each other out, some of which are directly in competition, some of which are, you know, essentially the support bands, kind of things. How does punk goes national, which is what one of the kind of the crucial moments in the book that we cross over from what is essentially a kind of a music world in London to become a national phenomenon that allows you to draw comparisons between London, Sheffield, Manchester and Liverpool. So how does punk go national?
It starts, I think, with one of the reviews that I'm just going to struggle to get my details right here. A review that Neil Spencer wrote in one of the weekly music magazines, and the Sex Pistols had supported. It's gone. So the Sex Pistols had played a support slot at the Marquee in London, and when it got written up, really the review was about the Sex Pistols. It wasn't about the band who they had been supporting, and famously in that review, Steve Jones had said, "We're not into music; we're into chaos." And of course, you've got these musos all over the country who religiously flick through the weekly music mags, looking for anything of interest. And that review seems to have sparked a huge amount of, well, I say a huge amount of interest. It's probably a tiny group of musos spread all around the country, but when they all saw it, they all got excited. So you get TV Smith and Gay Advert in, they were in Devon, I think. They read it and eventually decide actually to move to London on that basis, because there's obviously something exciting happening in London. But in Manchester, you get Pete Shelley and Howard Devoto, as they would later be known. They read this review and they think, right, we've just got to go to London. We've got to see this band. They borrow a car and they just head down to London to see the Sex Pistols. They meet the Sex Pistols. They are massively impressed. They invite the Sex Pistols to come back and play in Manchester, two very early out of London gigs for the Sex Pistols and widely celebrated ones. And you get other people who've read this review, Neil Spencer's review, who then decide to come and see the Sex Pistols in Manchester because, well, I think it's Martin Brammer, who was later in the Fall, says it said that they played Stooges songs and they were huge Stooges fans. So, but also it was these skinheads apparently playing because they saw, everybody had long hair, of course, at the time. But the Sex Pistols didn't. They had short hair. So what on earth? It was an outrage because skinheads were playing the Stooges. And so some of them just came along because they thought they were going to heckle. But then they get to this gig and they're kind of wiped out. So you have this... There's this sort of slow process through the music press whereby people are starting to find out about it and trying to find out more and do things. But then on the 1st of December 1976, the Sex Pistols get to do an interview on local television in London. And it wasn't actually their first television appearance. Actually, had been on a Northwest based programme that Tony Wilson did, So It Goes. And actually, they were quite controversial on that programme because Jordan, who was one of the women that worked in Sex, had a swastika armband on. She looked like a Nazi. And the Sex Pistols had gone mad on the stage anyway. And so they could have generated a huge amount of controversy at that point. But it was really this interview that they did on London weekend television with Bill Grundy that was the spark for punk going national. Because as far as you can tell, the host was drunk. The Sex Pistols had been in the green room all day and they were drunk. You could tell the story about what happened in slightly different ways, but it seems that Bill Grundy, the interviewer, had started to flirt a little bit with Susie, of Susie and the Banshees fame, who was one of the Sex Pistols' kind of inner circle of fans at the time. And this provoked one of the Sex Pistols, Steve Jones, I think, to call him a dirty something or other. And then Grundy retaliates and says, come on, say something controversial, say something naughty, which they then go on and do. And all of this is on Tea Time television. And like I say, it's only local London television, but the next morning in the press, the national press start to run with this, and you get some of the celebrated phrases associated with punk on the headlines that next, the Filth and the Fury, Filthy Luca, they're all headlines from that next that next morning. And there's a huge moral panic generated around punk. The Sex Pistols, I think, along with the Clash and the Damned, had been supposed to be going on a national tour shortly after this point in time, when probably they still would only have appealed to a small number of people. They'd have very much been a niche act. But they had something like about, I think it was 26 or so gigs lined up around the country. But these newspaper headlines after the Bill Grundy interview provoke a moral panic, And councils start intervening to prevent the gigs. And I think in the end, the Anarchy Tour, as it was called, only actually played four different places out of the 26 or so that it was supposed to have played. All the Sex Pistols had a record contract at that point in time with EMI, but the workers at the record pressing plant refused to press it originally because they were horrified at what had happened. And eventually EMI decided to pull out. So the EMI version of Anarchy in the UK became a collector's item because EMI decided they didn't want anything do with it, all of which could have looked pretty bleak for punk. The censors were coming down. There were attempts by all kinds of do-gooders to repress this and stop the nation's youth from being corrupted. But of course, as any sociologist would have told them, if you try and stop people in that way, you make it hugely exciting and sexy to young people. Who many of whom probably wouldn't have bothered with the Sex Pistols if it hadn't been for this huge furore that was created. And that really was punk going national. That was the point at which every sort of teenager, every self-respecting teenager in the land discovered punk and decided that this is what they wanted to be and what they wanted to do. Bands started to, punk nights started to take off in different towns and cities. Bands started to form and really the whole thing got going as a consequence of that. You know, there had been, like I say, the earlier precursors like Pete Shelley and Howard Devoto who formed Buzzcocks. But really, I think the going national was as a consequence of Bill Grundy and the moral panic.
The rest of the book is devoted to these other cities,
yeah,
and the evolution of a different kind of music,
yeah,
as well. I wonder, to bring the discussion to a close, whether you could maybe use Sheffield as the example to talk about how Sheffield was similar and how it was different to London. And how, particularly musically,
yeah,
the social network analysis shows us how a different kind of music emerges in Sheffield.
Yeah. Okay. So, in some senses, I'm not sure it's the Sheffield is the odd one in the pack,
yeah,
in some ways, because I think in Liverpool and Manchester you had great enthusiasm for punk.
Yeah.
And then you had innovators who, at a fairly early stage, decided that punk had had its moment,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
and it was time to move on and do something different. Sheffield, although there was a thriving punk scene in Sheffield, and it has been written up quite well, a lot of the movers and shakers in Sheffield were people who weren't as impressed by punk or as influenced, I don't think, by punk. And seem to have been interested in electronic music, and I think Cabaret Voltaire, the three members of Cabaret Voltaire, had been hugely influential in that. I think actually they, as much as anything, had been interested in just in electronics and in making weird noises, and they were probably. they were interested in film scores, so I think they'd been really really attracted by the Clockwork Orange film score, which was done by it was Walter Carlos, I think, who eventually became Wendy,
yeah,
Carlos. And so they were, a lot of the early Cabaret Voltaire stuff was just exploring sort of soundscapes, and I guess they've been influenced by Roxy Music and Brian Eno and these other kinds of things as well, but also particularly Krautrock and the Kraftwerk. But I think that what punk did was it created this sense of possibility, this sense that you can do things, and this sense that you should do things. And it sort of mobilised people to begin to organise musical events, regular kinds of musical events, including some at the what was called the NOWSOC at the university, and really those sorts of events attracted both the electronic music pioneers and the punks. They were probably organised for the punks, but the electronic music pioneers began to drift towards them as well. And I think in that process, the networks began to form in much the way that networks had begun to form around Sex Pistols gigs and around Malcolm McLaren's shop in London. And it was with the formation of those networks that, again, you had the, I suppose, what some people might call the social capital that allowed cultural events and cultural innovations to be organised, to get a hold, and for a thriving music world to begin to take place. But you also find, I mean, again, Sheffield was unusual in having perhaps fewer dedicated support personnel. So if you look in Liverpool and you look in Manchester, you find a reasonably largish bunch of slightly older men who are quite happy to take on the role of managing, who want to be movers and shakers. They don't necessarily want to play in bands themselves, but they do want to help and facilitate young musicians to do their own thing. And that was very similar, I think, to what McLaren and his cronies around Sex were doing. Sheffield is slightly different in that there aren't quite as many of those people, but there certainly are some. There's this very enigmatic character called Marcus Featherby in Sheffield, who, he's mysterious because apparently he changed his name upon coming to Sheffield and nobody quite knows who he was before he was Marcus Featherby, and then he left under a bit of a cloud and mystery, and apparently changed his name again. So it's this. I mean, God knows why. It might have been a strange guy that liked to change his name every now and then. I don't know. But he was a big organizer, and he managed quite a few of the different bands. He organized various labels at one point or another that put out music by Sheffield bands as well as by bands from further afield. And he did the another thing that crops up fairly commonly, certainly in Manchester and Liverpool and Sheffield, is the local area compilation album. So you get these compilations that showcase local talent, and Marcus Featherby did that for Sheffield. So you've got these movers and shakers, although, like I say, fewer of them in Sheffield, who begin to take on the role of organizer and enabling young bands to have spaces to play in and audiences to come and see them. But I think in Sheffield, interestingly, some of the bands do that themselves. So I got the impression, certainly from the archive, that the Cabaret Voltaire had played a hugely facilitative role. They were a huge influence on the Sheffield bands, because I think for a time they were the interesting Sheffield band, and lots of other Sheffield musicians went along to see them and were influenced by them. But Cabaret Voltaire had a studio, the Western Works, out in one of the old disused industrial buildings, and they let lots of the other bands go in there and record sessions and do various kinds of things like that. So although they were probably the key band in the city, they were also the key organisers and support personnel, I think, for other people. But actually, another thing I should mention about Sheffield was this council-run project, which had been an effort, I think, on behalf of the council to help young people become involved in the arts. And it had an odd name. It was meat whistle. It was called, which is obviously a kind of a strange sexual reference, which the council don't seem to have picked up on. And there are stories about this meat whistle being organised by these hippies who would walk around with no shoe. And it doesn't sound like the kind of thing that a council would do. But then having said that, of course, Sheffield in the 1970s was known as the Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire, and it had a very different kind of political take to much of the rest of the country, and it was quite an innovative and different place politically. Sheffield famously had ridiculously cheap bus fares and things because the council had these socialist ideas that they put into the city. But I still think they wouldn't have approved of meat whistle, thinking what was going on there. And meat whistle was a place where many of the people who went on to be part of those electronic bands initially met. So several, Ian Craig Marsh and Martin Ware of the Human League went there, along with Glenn Gregory, who they'd originally wanted to be the lead singer for the Human League, but later joined them in Heaven 17. You had people from the early punk bands, there was a band called 2.3, who were probably the first Sheffield punk band. He was at Paul Bower, he was involved in Meat Whistle, and he was also the person who ran Sheffield's first punk zine, Gunrubber. There were lots of them, and they interestingly formed, they formed a band. It wasn't the Human League people. There was some of those early people involved in Meat Whistle formed a band called Musical Vomit, which kind of sounds punk. It sounds like it's anticipating what punk did. And apparently they played a festival in 1974, which Polystyrene, who was, of course, the lead singer in X-Ray Specs, and she was from London, but she attended this music festival. She saw Musical Vomit play and allegedly said that Musical Vomit were the first punk band ever. I'm not going to endorse that any more than I would endorse any. But I think, I suppose it shows that this musical project was another kind of what network analysts sometimes refer to as a focus, or we refer to foci. And these are the times and places which draw people with similar kinds of interests together and allow them to form networks, which then allow them to engage in collective action of the kind that punk and post-punk involved. And I think that Meat Whistle was one of these foci. It was one of the places where all of these young people who were interested in a range of creative arts, but probably particularly music, first came together and formed friendships that would later form the basis of what became the early Sheffield music world. But the other thing I did, you sort of talked about the similarities. I mean, I looked at the network for London, I looked at the networks for Liverpool, for Manchester and for Sheffield. And really, if we look at the structural properties of the network, they're all quite similar. Now, to what extent that is because you need a particular type of network in order for music world to emerge, and to what extent it's just an effect of the fact that when you're doing music, you will generate networks that look in a particular kind of way. Who knows? But it's certainly it's an interesting. I think it's an interesting observation that these networks are all quite similar to one another, and that does suggest that at least the network structure of music worlds is perhaps predictable in certain kinds of ways.
There's a lot more I could ask you about the book. It's a really, really rich and really fascinating book. But just by way of conclusion, are you carrying on working around social network analysis of music worlds, or are you doing kind of completely different things for your future project at the moment?
I'm continuing. So I am. I've actually organised in a a symposium here in Manchester on music and networks to tell you about in June, which will bring people from internationally, really, who are working in these areas. And we're going to have a big symposium on music and networks and music worlds. And my own contribution to that has been to look, and actually I was still putting the network together just when you arrived, to look at two-tone and the... Because two-tone is an interesting music world, I think, because it's a highly significant post-punk strand. And I felt when I finished the book, the bigger mission was that I probably should have said something more about two-tone. So I'm atoning for my sins there, or two-toning for my sins there, maybe. But also it's interesting because it's much more ethnically diverse. It's interesting because it's translocal in a way that I think the other music worlds that I've looked at perhaps, well, they are, and I look at that in the book, but two-tone is somehow fundamentally translocal in a way that perhaps wasn't true for the other worlds that I looked at. And it raises all kinds of interesting questions. So, yeah, I'm carrying on two-tone and also this symposium.
Sounds like it needs another book, two-tone.
Watch this space, who knows?
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. In this episode, I was talking to Professor Nick Crossley from the University of Manchester about his new book, Networks of Sound, Style and Subversion.